First, we take a look at the big stories playing out in national politics this week. The U.S. Justice Department is backing President Trump's pick as interim attorney general after criticism from Democrats. Some big election results are still being finalized in Florida and Georgia. And House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi is campaigning within her caucus to regain her former role as House Speaker. Our question for you this week is, what do you want to see from the leaders of either party in Congress? For Democrats, is Nancy Pelosi the smart choice again for House Speaker, or does the party need a change? What direction should new House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy take for Republicans? And how about the Senate? Should there have been changes there? There weren't. But do you think there should have been? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Reed Wilson is national correspondent at The Hill. Reed, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. How you doing?
Well, pretty good. Now, let's start with this day after Election Day story. Attorney General Jeff Sessions resigned at the request of President Trump. The president appointed Matthew Whitaker to be the acting attorney general. Now, talk about some of the controversy over whether he was eligible to be appointed as attorney general.
Right. So Matthew Whitaker is a political appointee from the state of Iowa. He worked on the Trump campaign. He was then installed as chief of staff under Jeff Sessions for the entire Justice Department. And, you know, that is not a Senate confirmable position to be a, sort of a political appointee in the Justice Department. And the Democrats say that according to the Constitution, if you're going to be appointed to another cabinet-level position or a Senate-confirmable position, you have to have gone through the Senate confirmation process to begin with. Now, there is another figure at the Department of Justice, the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who has been confirmed by the Senate, and ordinarily he would have been the one in line to serve as the acting Attorney General until President Trump appoints somebody new. Now, of course, this has a little added flavor because Matthew Whitaker has been outspoken in his opposition to the Russia investigation. He wrote an op-ed about it for CNN back in 2017, went on Fox News a bunch to talk about his opposition to the Russia investigation. And, of course, as we know, President Trump's favorite place from which to recruit staff happens to be the channel of Fox News. Democrats have a lot of questions about who Matthew Whitaker is now that he is overseeing the Russia investigation and he has taken back that oversight from Rod Rosenstein, and whether or not that's legitimate. Already we've seen some states, including the state of Maryland, has actually filed suit to try to get a federal judge to declare Rod Rosenstein the acting attorney general. It's not clear how fast or whether or not that's going to be adjudicated before there's a new pick. But, you know, President Trump had known for a long time that he was going to get rid of Jeff Sessions. And the fact is, there was just no appointee waiting in the wings.
There's been talk, as you mentioned, of Matthew Whitaker's comments on the Russia probe in the past and some calls, particularly from Democrats, for him to recuse himself for that, as Jeff Sessions had done previously. Is there any indication that the Justice Department is reviewing this idea that he might be recused as Jeff Sessions was?
Well, the Justice Department spokeswoman had said that they will consult with the ethics officials who are, they're sort of career officials who are not partisan appointees, about whether or not there should be some kind of recusal. But the fact is that it doesn't look like there's actually going to be. They made a point to say that statement was sort of a general message. Yes, we will consult with these ethics lawyers, without saying it was actually in response to any one particular issue. So it doesn't appear to me that he's going to recuse himself, even though he has expressed such an overt opinion about the matter.
Now, we've seen a brief from Justice Department officials making the legal case that, yeah, in fact, they can Matthew Whitaker can be appointed to this temporary post. As you say, if this goes to court, it could take a while. Do we have any idea of a timeline for the appointment of a permanent replacement for Jeff Sessions?
No, we don't. And as a matter of fact, it looks like there are going to be more cabinet officials who are given the boot before a new attorney general is named. There are a lot of names floating around there. There's, you know, Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey. We've heard his name. Jeff Landry, the attorney general of Louisiana. Pam Bondi, the outgoing attorney general of Florida. We've heard all of their names. But it's not clear to me that any of those people are sort of on a sure path to the nomination. And the fact is, this White House moves pretty slowly at times, frankly, because they just haven't done sort of the staffing that other administrations have done a lot more quickly.
Talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. Reed, you just teased that idea that there might be other departures. There's reporting that the president not happy after the elections, possible staff shakeups. Let's talk first of all, First Lady Melania Trump, her staff person effectively called for the firing of a national security official, National Security Advisor John Bolton's deputy. Unusual, a little bit?
Oh, amazingly unusual. We don't usually see the First Lady get involved, or as we call it, the East Wing, get involved with the business of the West Wing. The stark example is, back during the Reagan administration, when Nancy Reagan had some real problems with Ronald's chief of staff, Don Regan, and eventually got organized to get him fired. But the fact is, we don't see First Ladies getting involved in public policy, and I should say public policy at sort of the White House staffing level. And, of course, we also don't see the First Lady getting involved in National Security Council matters. And as you say, this woman who was dismissed was the number two at the National Security Council. Apparently, they had clashed over the First Lady's trip to Africa, which she undertook. Was that last month or back in September? Anyway, recently. This has been a source of some tension. And by the way, I should say, apparently Melania Trump is not the only person who clashed with this Deputy National Security Council member, or Deputy National Security Council director. She had also clashed with Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, and even with White House Chief of Staff John Kelly. So maybe there was not a lot of sad faces when she walked out the door.
And staying with security advisors and issues, Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen, President Trump has been unhappy with her performance in the past, talk that she might be on her way out, and one of her biggest advocates, Chief of Staff John Kelly.
Right. And now the two of them have worked together for a very long time. Nielsen was John Kelly's deputy as chief of staff when he first took the job, before she was appointed to head the DHS, which, of course, was his old job. So John Kelly has been maneuvering to save Kirstjen Nielsen for quite a while now. It does not appear that he's going to be successful. If the reports are true that he is threatened to resign if she gets the boot, this time, if he threatens to resign, that threat may be accepted.
I want to turn to, we would talk about leadership in the House and Senate. We know who a lot of the leaders next year are going to be as of basically today, right? Mitch McConnell stays on, right? Senate Majority Leader. Chuck Schumer, Senate Minority Leader. What do we know in the House so far?
Well, we know that Kevin McCarthy, the Republican congressman from California and the current House Majority Leader, has won election to become the House Minority Leader next year. He defeated a guy named Jim Jordan, who's one of the heads of the House Freedom Caucus, the group of arch conservatives, by about a 3-1 margin. So McCarthy won pretty easily there. There are a lot of conservatives who are very nervous about McCarthy. They don't think that he has sort of the ideological background that they want to see in a House Republican leader. But the fact is, McCarthy's worked for a very long time to raise money and get Republicans elected. He's a very affable guy, somebody who, I don't know, when I got a new job once and he texted me congratulations. He's that kind of guy. But there's this sort of hints at the internecine rivalry within the Republican conference, tensions between, call them mainstream Republicans, and the hardest right, a faction that's probably about a quarter of the caucus. So that tells you a little something there. On the Democratic side, I haven't checked in the last 5 minutes, but they are voting today on whether or not Nancy Pelosi will be the next House Speaker, or will be, I should say, the Democratic nominee for House Speaker. They don't actually pick a Speaker until they formally convene as the 116th Congress in January, but she is likely to win, basically because there's no clear opposition to Nancy Pelosi. There is no candidate who has come forward and said, I will challenge you and rally the votes to get behind somebody else. So Pelosi's sort of the only game in town right now, and until Democrats are able to rally around somebody else, she's going to be the only game in town. The interesting part of this is that there are quite a number of House Democratic candidates who either wouldn't say that they would support Pelosi. I had a couple of candidates that I talked to this year who ended up winning, basically refused to tell me who they would vote for Speaker of the House if Nancy Pelosi were on the ballot. And, you know, if they get to the floor, the House Speaker isn't just the person who gets the most votes within the majority party. The House Speaker has to get 218 votes, a majority of the members of the House of Representatives. And Democrats have a buffer there. They've got at least 232 seats. I think that's probably going to go up to 234, 235 by the time all the ballots are counted. So they've got a little bit of room. They can give some of their members a free pass to vote for somebody else, which is what we've seen some other candidates do in the last couple of years when she was on the ballot. But the fact is, she's probably going to have the votes. She is the Democratic Party's number one fundraiser by a mile and a half, and she's got the relationship. You know, I always joke that the big city machine politics, we've really seen them sort of collapse in places like New York and Boston and Philadelphia and Chicago in recent years, but the one that still exists is the D'Alessandro machine. Heard Nancy Pelosi's father, Tommy D'Alessandro, was the mayor of Baltimore, built a big political machine, and she's still running a D'Alessandro machine in the House Democratic Conference.
We're talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, looking at some of the week's top news in national politics. You can weigh in on this issue we're talking about now at 800-642-1234 on these congressional leadership positions. If you're a Democrat, do you support Nancy Pelosi as the once and future House Speaker, or do you want to see a change in leadership among Democrats? If you're a Republican, what direction do you want to see Kevin McCarthy take as House Minority Leader? Do you think they should have gone to a more conservative candidate like Jim Jordan? Would you have liked to see a change, which didn't happen in either party, in the U.S. Senate? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Reed Wilson of The Hill, catching us up on the week's top stories in national politics. We're staying for a few moments with the issue of leadership in the House and Senate. And we'll go now to Owen in Wyawega. Owen, hi.
Hey, Rob. How's it going this afternoon?
Good. How are you doing?
Great. So, yeah, I remember the Tea Party. I'm 40, going to be 40 coming up here. It wasn't very long ago, and I'm sure all of you that are contemporary folks that have voted this year, most of you probably remember the Tea Party, too. And Nancy Pelosi was a big threat to the Tea Party. The Tea Party made a lot of problems for Nancy Pelosi. I think using Nancy Pelosi again as the Speaker of the House is probably a bad move if we want to work in a more bipartisan, less polarized type of political environment going into the future here so we can get some things done. I think using the same people over and over again is redundant, and it's time for new folks like that young Kennedy to try to step up and work his way in. And he's probably going to appeal a lot to more of the demographic of younger voters this year.
Owen, thanks a lot for calling in. Reed, it's interesting. Nancy Pelosi, obviously a target for Republicans often in political ads. Online, you see a lot of people on the left wing of the Democratic Party thinking she's too centrist. And then you see opposition from some more moderate Midwestern Democrats who think she's too far to the left. And they want some generational change, too. All those different arguments against her, yet she's probably going to win.
Yeah, and Nancy Pelosi is one of these people who has been, you know, in the center of the public eye for a very long time. You know, she first got elected to Congress in the 1980s, got into Democratic leadership, correct me if I'm wrong, 14 years ago, I think it was. And, you know, anybody who spends that much time in the national eye is going to be pilloried as, you know, a bad guy, basically, and seen as some kind of hyper-partisan. And, you know, the funny thing, there's this big disconnect between how she is portrayed in Republican campaign advertising, where she's this perfect foil because she is not from, you know, the San Francisco area. She represents the city of San Francisco, that hotbed of, you know, crazy liberalism. And on the other hand, she's one of the more effective legislators that we've seen in recent years. And I'd put her on par with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell as just an incredibly qualified legislator who has a roster of accomplishments. You know, there are a lot of Democrats who say that the Affordable Care Act, love it or hate it, the fact is it passed, would not have passed without her as Speaker of the House. And there are some other things that that they credit to her or Republicans blame her for as well. So the fact is, you know, anybody who's going to be in the national eye for that long is going to be a target of political attacks. And the Democrats are, in fact, opening themselves up to a couple more years of that of those attacks by reelecting her. But, again, she is their best fundraiser, and she's probably their best legislative tactician.
We'll keep watching what happens there. I want to move to some still ongoing election issues now. Florida and Georgia. A lot of overheated rhetoric, I think, going on in Florida, and now we're seeing literally some of these recount machines physically overheating.
Yeah, that's a pretty crazy story, isn't it? I think that was in Palm Beach County. I read that in the Philadelphia Inquirer this morning. That there are actually some machines that have been used so much that they're now overheating. But that, you know, they're still counting votes in both Florida and Georgia. Florida is undergoing a recount. It looks like it's going to take another couple of days. And I think Palm Beach County has gotten an extension now to continue counting the rest of their votes. But, you know, we're hearing this sort of drumbeat from the Democratic lawyers who are going to court basically every 5 minutes, and the Republicans are going to court every 5 minutes, too, with their own motions. But, you know, the drumbeat is sort of count every vote. And this is something that goes back to the Florida recounts that we all remember to our own horror back in 2000, 18 years ago, when, you know, the same, it's in fact some of the same Democratic lawyers who were arguing Bush v. Gore are now arguing the race between Bill Nelson, the incumbent senator, and Rick Scott, the incumbent governor, and the gubernatorial candidates, Ron DeSantis, the Republican, and Andrew Gillum, the Democrat. Important to say that Scott's lead right now is narrower than over Nelson than DeSantis's lead over Gillum. If anybody wins, makes a surprising comeback, it would be Bill Nelson before it would be Andrew Gillum. But the fact is, there are at least thousands more ballots to count, overseas absentee ballots, military ballots. And I think this sort of highlights something about the way Americans conduct elections. We tend to vote a lot by mail these days, more and more so, especially in states like Florida and Georgia and a bunch of western states. And the fact is, it takes a long time to count those ballots. You know, there are still races being counted out in California. I just saw a couple hours ago a Democrat had been declared a winner in a district in the Central Valley of California. So, yeah, you know, it takes a while to count these mail-in ballots.
One question, and we'll keep watching those stories. Reed, I know you and I aren't the official arbiters of what constitutes a wave election, but as you look at the results from last week and results trickling in, what are your thoughts on whether we just had a blue wave?
Yeah, so let me offer the case for and the case against. The case for is the fact that the House Democrats picked up more seats in last week's election than in any election since the post-Watergate election, more than 2006, more than 2008. Nobody would not describe 06 and 08 as waves. So in that case, add in, by the way, the number of governorships, including in Wisconsin, where Democrats picked up, they ended up picking up 7 Republican-held seats. Nobody would not describe that as a wave. Now, the counterargument to that is, well, in the Senate, Republicans actually picked up seats. They picked up at least one. If Scott hangs on in Florida, they'll pick up two. How do you call it a wave if it's a split decision like that? I would say that, you know, at the beginning of the cycle, we were looking at Democrats running for reelection in 10 states that President Trump won in 2016. And if you had told any Republican strategist that they would only pick up one or two, or net one or two out of those states, they would have been real depressed. So the fact is, you know, Democrats did pretty much as best they could. The one possible bright spot for Republicans is in state legislatures. The Republicans lost about 300 seats, well, a little more than 300 seats across the country. I will note, by the way, that one of the very few states, I think I counted 5 states, where Republicans netted seats in state legislatures was in Wisconsin, right, where they gained a Senate seat. So on the state legislative level, yeah, Democrats picked up 300 seats, but that's only about a third of the number of seats that Democrats lost under President Obama.
And then finally, President Trump made this trip to France this weekend, meeting with European leaders. There's tension with French President Emmanuel Macron, president not going on a prominent military cemetery visit. Talk about some of what came out of that trip.
Yeah, it has not been the best week for the White House. But then again, I feel like I could say that in pretty much every week that they've been in office. You know, President Trump got to Paris for this commemoration of the 100th anniversary of World War One, decided against going to the cemetery with other leaders, and, you know, blamed the weather to begin with, then blamed the Secret Service, then blamed the notion that he would have caused a traffic jam in Paris. But it appears that the backstory is that the president was irritated, and he saw that how badly Republicans had done in the midterm elections, and spent all his time watching television at the U.S. Embassy in Paris, growing angrier and angrier that he had basically declared victory at a time when it's obvious now that he lost, you know, more seats than any Republican president since Richard Nixon. Well, I guess it would have been since Gerald Ford. But this was not a great. I think he was on the ground for 43 hours in Paris. His trip started with an angry confrontation with Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, and a phone call as he was heading over to Paris. And on the way out, you know, Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, called out nationalism, which is, of course, the foundation of President Trump's agenda. And that was, you know, a very public insult, if you will, in front of 70 other world leaders. And, you know, and public insults are not something that President Trump suffers gladly.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Reid, wouldn't ask you to predict the future, but is there a shoe you're waiting to drop right about now?
Oh, I mean, we've all heard reports that Robert Mueller's team is prepared to issue more subpoenas and indictments, perhaps. I actually thought we were going to be talking about that today.
Yeah, me too, actually.
Mueller has tended to move on Fridays, so let's see what happens on Friday.
All right, Reid, thanks, as always, for joining us.
You got it. Sorry about the noise in the background.
Wasn't bad. Thanks a lot. That's Reid Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill. He was with us, I believe, from an airport for a look at this week's biggest stories in national politics.